questions that could reveal your purpose in life? What if there were questions that could surface the change most meaningful to you? And what if answering those questions would give you the power to ignite? Welcome to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. These are big conversations that lead to self-discovery. Together, let's embark on the leader's journey and ignite meaningful change.
So let's look at vision and let's look at story for a second together. Definitions of words are so important. Don't you agree? They define the makeup. They expose the depth. Even etymology can show us the story of the word itself.
And you are going to experience that. You already see it, Jonathan. I'm grateful for that, mm-hmm. among other things. But you will note as you go through the Illumify Game Changer, words matter, and we are very precise with our words in this.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that. It's so important, what you've just said. Okay. Yeah.
So here's the question. What do you see as the distinction between visionary and storyteller?
That's a great question. I have a starting point in my mind. It's about the physical posture of these two individuals in my mind. I see the storyteller, and this is perhaps because of the ancient image of who a storyteller is, where for hundreds of years stories were passed on orally from one generation to the next, from one village and town to the next. And so I have this image of the storyteller sitting in the middle of a group of people, perhaps around a campfire. It's another ancient image we have of people sharing stories around a fire. And then the visionary, in contrast, in my mind's eye, is somebody who is standing alone, possibly at the top of a hill or a mountain, looking out. There's this idea of looking out from a ship almost. These images are coming spontaneously to me now as I try to see this physical posture of what a visionary is. And it's somebody looking out from this height somehow. I don't know why that matters, but somebody looking out into the future and who is maybe seeing something that nobody else has seen yet. And maybe something that she has not seen yet and is only seeing it for the first time. But there's something for me in that physical posture. And it also suggests, I think, that the storyteller, like our traditional view of the writer, the novelist, is either looking backwards in time, looking back into history, looking into the dramas of a family or a town or a community or a country, and trying to make sense of that and turning that into a new story that makes sense for people. But as I said earlier, it doesn't have to be looking into the past. It can also be looking inward. So the writer who looks inside herself to find that hidden story and bring it to the surface, to dig and dig and dig and bring it to the surface. And in contrast, the visionary is almost looking into thin air at something that doesn't exist yet, maybe.
So phenomenal correlations.
That's my first sense, just to...
Love it. Okay, so here's the follow-up, just for that height reference.
Yes.
Can you be with the people to lead the people?
Well, it's funny. You say that, and the image that instantaneously came into my mind, and this is because I think we talked about Martin Luther King earlier. Mm-hmm. When I see Martin Luther King, I see him marching with the people, marching with his people, exactly as you said. So I gave you this lonely image of the visionary standing on top of a mountain or
at
the bow of a ship. Yeah, the bow of a ship, maybe.
Not even on land with the people.
Yeah, exactly. Very distant. Yes, yes.
I have to say, though, Catherine, you made a quantum leap between visionary and leader. Do you see the connection, Jonathan?
Not yet. I can feel it there.
Well, we can go there too. I can make a note on that
good,
too.
Good.
Okay.
Out there somewhere. But I love that question about.
And yet you answered it, Jonathan.
Yeah. 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 Well, you're prompting me. You're prompting me. But I love that question about the leader being with her people, marching with her people. I think that feels right. But let me just come back to the storytelling thing and the difference between the two. Because I think while they may be different in that physical posture, and maybe in their relationship with time, and maybe in their relationship with the people around them, I think they have to end up in the same place ultimately. And that is, and it's another word, it's a big word, which I think is tragically unfashionable at the moment, and we need to bring it back into fashion soon, I think.
Let's do it now.
No time like the present.
That word is the truth.
Yeah.
The truth. And even though the visionary and the storyteller may occupy these different physical postures and maybe using different materials for their story and what they're trying to do, and even if the visionary, as you said, Catherine, cuts a lonelier figure than the storyteller, who seems to be part of something, part of a community, talking to an audience which is
social,
gathered, yes, gathered closely around her.
A close circle, even.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. In spite of that, I think they have to arrive at the same destination, which is the truth. And if we go back to vision and bring in vision here, a vision has to be true. The powerful ideas of the totalitarian dictators of the 20th century, Stalin, Hitler, they were not visions in my book. They were not visions. They were tragically that they were able to, certainly in the case of Hitler, create a story and we have no illusion. This was backed by horrific violence as well. But nonetheless, let's be clear, the ability to tell a story that would mobilize people. But it wasn't a vision in my book. First and foremost, because it was simply not true. Hitler and Stalin, and I would say any totalitarian leader, and I would include Putin in this today, it's not only that they don't care about the truth. It's that they're in the business of denying the very existence of truth.
And inverting it, even.
Yes, absolutely. War is peace. Ignorance is strength. Freedom is slavery. That's
fake news.
And that takes us back to the previous discussion about truth in our politics today, that there's a very, very, very dangerous word or notion that has come into our political language over the last 6-7 years. People have started to talk, and if you talk, you're already accepting. It's a first step towards accepting. People have talked about a post-truth society. I think it's incredibly dangerous. It's profoundly wrong. And if our democracies are to survive and thrive, we need to urgently rediscover why the truth matters and what the tools are to get to the truth.
And I think it's important to pause here and ensure that all of us and anyone listening shares the same understanding, the same definition of truth, So let's start, Jonathan, with what is truth to you?
For me, I think there are a number of aspects to it. We've talked a lot today already about story, fiction. The fact that the novel has gone hand in hand with the growth and the flourishing of European democracy over the last 200-300 years. And yes, when I say this, let me be absolutely clear, I am not presenting a Panglossian vision of European democracy over the... In fact, I'd say the opposite. Europe, I think I said this earlier, Europe, to create the Europe that we have today, the European Union of today, founded on human rights, the rule of law, democracy, solidarity, a free press, that last part being extremely important because we're coming to that question now, free press, independent media. If we have built these institutions around those values, it's because we had to reach the utter darkness and depravity of the Holocaust. So to come back to your question, Marianne, truth, that there is story is part of that, because when a novelist writes a story, she is trying to get to the truth, a version of the truth, a human truth. A great novel is not simply an attempt to entertain us or to get us to think about important issues or allow us to escape the drudgery of day-to-day life. And all of those things are fine. There's nothing wrong with those things. But a great novel, and I'd say any great piece of fiction and any great work of art, is trying to get to the truth. And there isn't a single truth. It's the pursuit of the truth that matters. It's the pursuit of the truth that matters. Democratic society is built on the idea that there is not one truth that dominates. Our ability to live side by side in a democracy with different religions, that's, if we look at our world today, this is absolutely critical. If a democratic society is comfortable, this is really important, if a democratic society is comfortable with the coexistence of different religions, then what are we saying? There are different truths, and we might say competing truths, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But the truth that unites them all and reconciles them is the truth, and this takes us back to Martin Luther King, the truth that we are able to live together peacefully and respect for each other, even as we have competing visions of the good life. And that's not a contradiction. It's the heart of what makes democracy beautiful and inspiring when it works. Mm. So there is that aspect of the truth, the multiplicity of truths, because as humans we are complex. But it's also that factual reality that we talked about earlier. That is important. That factual reality can and must go hand in hand with our storytelling. They're not contradictory. They go hand in hand. So in 1984, 2 + 2 = 5. And that whole idea of how a human being can be not only forced to accept that 2 + 2 = 5, but ultimately to celebrate joyously that 2 + 2 = 5, to get to that stage is a dark, dark path that we must avoid at all costs. So the idea of a factual reality that we share, daily life would be impossible without it. To answer your question, Marianne, I think that those two aspects go hand in hand. The factual reality, which is supported by science, independent, free media, one of the pillars of our democracy, but also in parallel, hand in hand, our ability to tell stories and to mobilize people and win people to a new cause, a new vision of the future for our society. that is also full of truth, in the same way that great novels are full of truth and great pop songs are full of truth.
The very fact, and your phrase was multiple versions, you know, for example, with various religions living cooperatively within one democracy, the very fact that we can see as humans, or some of us can, multiple versions of the truth lends itself to being manipulated. And therefore, you know, what was alternative facts was the expression used in the States. I want to go to the root of the word, Jonathan, because when I look up truth, I'll go there in a second, but it roots, of course, to the word true, which has many pieces to it that I think are really interesting. I want to go to the very root of it first. It's from the Old English, West Saxon, you would appreciate that, and it's defined as faithful, trustworthy. Trustworthy. Steadfast as an oak, agreeing with a certain standard. And then you can describe things like true love, etc. When you actually look at it as a noun, proper alignment. The property possessed by something that is in correct or proper alignment. So if it's not true, it's out of true, it's not in proper alignment. As a verb, it's to make it level or concentric, true it up. As an adjective, consistent with fact or reality, not false. Conforming to definitive criteria, worthy of being depended on. And that gets to trust, right? Not pretended, sincerely felt or expressed, such as true grief. Genuine is another synonym. Rightly so called, such as true courage. In tune. Accurate.
Very much speaks to that true self, false self.
Right.
The alignment with a property. Fascinating wording in that definition.
Isn't it? Yeah. It's so beautifully put. Let me just go to now truth, a fact, truth as a noun. A fact that has been verified, you've used facts, conformity to reality or actuality, a true statement, the quality of being near to the true value. Is that all congruent, consistent with your understanding of truth?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's exactly what you were saying earlier, I think, Catherine, when you were talking about etymology, the importance of the etymology of words, where they come from. It tells us so much.
It reveals a lot, doesn't it?
It does, it does.
Because words can get distorted over time easily. We've seen that in the last few years alone. So when you actually go to the root of it, the origin of it, you see what it was meant to signify.
The first thing, one of the things you said there, Marianne, you talked about the strength of the oak, and I suddenly realized this can't be a coincidence. The oak tree from the story of Robin Hood is the crest of our football team, Nottingham Forest, and it now is revealed to me as this deep, ultimate truth about my football team, and that they've been this force for good for decades, that they are the true team, the oak. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The thing is, Jonathan, it's so evident truth matters to you. It's vital, isn't it?
Well, if only because of the moment we're in now. How do we get out of the political, geopolitical and moral crisis that we're in now? Truth has to be part of that battle. You talked in your journey into the etymology of the word. You started talking about, you were getting very close to ideas of trust. And I think that's fundamental. If I look at Denmark, the country where I live now, and I'm bravely learning the Danish language, which
that is brave.
it's a wonderful language. And if you are English, or if you're an English speaker or a German speaker, you have a free entry into the language because there are so many similarities in the structure and the vocabulary.
That is true. In my defense, having tried to and still trying to learn it, Jonathan, my teacher did say to me, Marianne, if you spoke German, you would find this easier.
And that's true. And that's true.
And yet it's still not, is it?
Well, the Germans at least have, I'm going to annoy my Danish friends now, but I say this out of love and good humor. At least the Germans pronounce all of their consonants.
That's true. They don't jump. You don't have to jump over words like we do in Danish.
Listen, if either of you want to continue parts of these conversations in Danish, do not know. I will not be offended at all.
Well, what I am going to do, Catherine, is bring in one word. Now, I may be off the mark here. I may be getting my etymology wrong. But something tells me that when the Danes say, I believe something to be true, I think something to be true, they'll say, jeg tror. Mm-hmm. Jeg tror. Okay. And I think tror and tro, the infinitive, yeah. Tro, as I say, I could be way off the mark here, but something is telling me that we're getting close to the truth here. Yeah. And that Danish word for to believe is close to the modern English word of true.
True.
I think.
Interesting.
I think.
That's fascinating.
But even if I'm wrong on that, I will say one thing about Danish society as I try to win my friends back now.
I don't really think you've lost any, Jonathan.
One of the reasons why modern Danish society is so successful, from its food to its football team, to its welfare state, to its public infrastructure and public transport, everything works beautifully if you've been there. It's all built on deep, deep layers of trust. You see that in the country. It's such a vital ingredient of Denmark's modern success.
And I wonder if the root of that is you can trust us to take care of you.
Yeah, right. It's a lovely notion.
And when that is alleviated, that concern is alleviated, and then on top of that, at every juncture, there's another manifestation of something that builds trust. You use the term layer upon layer. That runs deep, and that's rarely ever the case. It's so easy to erode trust. And then when that's done, it's near impossible to regain it. So to have trust running so deep.
Yeah, absolutely. And Catherine, I want to come back to something you were saying earlier. It's mm-hmm. also that there's a bridge here back to the relationship within ourselves, that inner conversation
yes.
with ourselves, the search for the good life, but also the relationships with other people. So the way in which we become our true selves. And here there is truth as well, because what we're seeking to be is to be true to ourselves. We want to be true to ourselves. And I think that's what David White is getting at when he talks about crisis. We have a story that we tell about ourselves. We believe that to be true. We have to be. We have to believe that it's true, otherwise we would suffer and we
wouldn't be safe.
We wouldn't be safe. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be safe. We wouldn't be sane. But if we are open, and I say this as somebody who in recent years has, I'm really trying to open myself to crisis.
Wonderful. We'll get there.
Yes. Thank yeah. you. Bring it on. Bring it on.
Are you implying this is going to be a crisis?
Do you know what? I have two questions here that potentially shift you into confrontation with yourself. And I was going to pull them back and I don't feel the need to anymore. So it's great.
No, I genuinely believe that. I think we have to go through at least one crisis, a day. Yeah, okay.
57 cards, Jonathan.
57 cards.
And we haven't even started them yet.
I know. I can't quite believe that. but yeah, crisis. Crisis yeah. as a way.
Confrontation.
Confrontation And if I had to, and I've had this conversation with my partner Liz and my family and my friends already, it's where I'm sitting now in my life. Crisis feels as if it's something that is absolutely necessary to the good life.
Absolutely.
That you cannot lead the good life, and you cannot get to the truth, whatever that truth is for you.
Yeah.
You cannot get to the truth without going through crisis.
So here's this misconception that comes from that fundamental tenet. People misconstrue the statement that growth comes with struggle or challenge or pain, and it's that pain that catalyzes the growth. This is a much more all-encompassing concept, this concept of confrontation and crisis. When one gets on the other side of this type of crisis, or when one survives it, there is an organic redefinition of life for that individual. It's as though now we see more of what life is, what it can be, and are willing to explore what those possibilities are. And that incrementally, going from a smaller space to a redefined larger perception of life, can very well be a representation of that good life, better life, fuller life.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
And I just hope I can get there.
Oh, it's going to be fun. It's going to be good. You sound like you already know how to do it. Come on now.
No. trust me.
There's this symphony going on in this exchange between the three of us that is connecting so many fundamental components of the foundation that we are building to stand on for the conversation as it unfolds over the next 18 years or however long we take to answer these cards.
18.
I would love to go back for a moment, and I don't even know if you're finished answering your question, but I'd love to go back for a moment to this distinction between the visionary and the storyteller, specifically as you related it to linearity of time. So the storyteller looking back at the past, translating it into the future to make it relevant, understood, and applicable, and the visionary looking out into the future, into this invisible type of construct that hopefully will come.
And what doesn't exist yet.
And what doesn't exist yet. Now, when we take that to heart, here's a question for you. How does one communicate a vision of the future in current times? And here the emphasis on current times is you have to make it understood. And sometimes vision of future is a vision of something that has no value associated with it yet because it is not yet identified by the populace.
And who may be complacent with what, at whatever level of contentment or misery, complacent about things staying the same way.
Because that familiarity component comes into play, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Life is so full of chaos, so full of distractions, so full of external
stimuli. But it's what I know. It's what I know.
And just to manage without drowning in it, we must stay familiar.
Exactly. And, you know, if that were to change, like, that's the unknown.
Yes.
How do we go there?
Exactly. What visionary will lead us there?
I think you've almost quoted, and I think this is one of those apocryphal quotes where the person himself didn't actually say it, but it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
because it's the sense and what we've retained today, which matters. I think Albert Einstein may have said at some point, not in exactly these words, but something similar, that a problem can never be solved in the terms of its creation.
Beautiful. Yes.
You know, and
yes.
I think that speaks to what you were saying, that
beautiful.
Some problems which are so difficult and profound that we simply have to find a new language, a whole new way of seeing the problem to even have a chance of addressing it. And this perhaps is where the visionary comes in. If the storyteller, and I say this, and I want to be clear here, I've apologized to the Danes, my Danish friends. I need to apologize as well to my writing friends. I'm not in any way relegating or diminishing the role of the storyteller. Far from it. But there is this sense of the storyteller using words and stories to make sense of the past and what has happened, to make sense of trauma. I'm not denying that many great writers of fiction invent completely new words at worlds. Science fiction is a brilliant political tool, as well as a work of fiction, a brilliant political tool in the sense that we are, through science fiction, imagining new worlds and new ways of living. What's more political than that? An exploration of what's possible. Explorations of ways of living together, and also new threats, which are possible. But the visionary, in contrast to that, is perhaps looking for something which has not taken form at all yet, not even in her
mind.
Imagination yet.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's a search which, and again, it's important for me to say this, there's not something better going on here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the visionary is in any way doing something more important or more urgent, but it exists in a different space. And I think the search for the truth is different. And it might be a new truth that fits the new circumstances, or a new truth that opens the path to something better.
You noted the importance of the pursuit of the truth. That's what matters, not necessarily an absolute truth. And I can absolutely see a reality where that is paramount. If we explore the word pursuit for a moment, and the reason I'm going here isn't because I want to immerse us in more definitions. It is more the engagement with, or the activity of, pursuing truth. Mm. And how important it is, that I'd like to look at for a moment. If the populace is not engaged in the pursuit of truth, what happens to the people? And what additional challenges does that impose upon the organizers of the populace?
Yeah, I think this really gets to the heart of what we're talking about here. If you'll allow me just to briefly repeat something I said earlier.
Please.
About the pursuit of the truth, because interestingly, it's your word here, the pursuit, that actually becomes more important.
It's absolutely.
It's the pursuit of the truth, because
it's really how the life is defined through that pursuit.
Yes.
That action.
Yes. Exactly. So if there is something good and enduring in our democracies, the thing that gives me hope for the survival of our democracies is that we have shown again and again this thirst to pursue the truth. I gave the example of journalists, reporters, investigators, some of the bravest people in our societies, the people who would take on the corrupt politician, the mafia boss, but would also go and work in a war zone. Incredibly brave people who are putting their body in the way of harm and risking their lives to get to the truth, to get to the truth. But it's not only them, it's judges, magistrates, all the people who work in the system of an independent judiciary, who are also in constant pursuit of the truth. It's in our scientists, where the scientific method is about getting to the truth by trial, error, experimentation, and then accepting when your thesis was wrong and when your thesis needs to be replaced. by something better, because the facts have shown that your theory was wrong. And that's the pursuit. The pursuit of the truth in science is that the process never ends. Sure, I'm not a scientist, so I'm on very, 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 very thin ice here.
You know, I'm imagining my husband listening to this in the car on the way to work, and he is a scientist.
Oh, no.
So I'm just listening to him talking through his rationale of what is happening here. Can I justify what I'm listening to?
All right, okay. Do I stop or carry on?
Absolutely.
I'm going to walk
pressure.
Into this now.
No pressure, walk into it.
I'm going to walk onto the ice. As a non-scientist who, thanks to the English education system, was able to abandon all natural sciences at the age of 16. Yeah, deep sigh. How I regret that. But I do believe that science, by its nature, is a constant, tireless and unending pursuit of the truth. I can't imagine any scientist who has a heroic vision of a future where, oof, we don't have to do any more experiments because we just know everything now. No, there is a thirst for knowledge. There is curiosity. These things are deeply, deeply hardwired into the human soul, in some people more than others. Yeah. And so whether it's the scientist or the judge or the journalist or the teacher, or also the explorer, people who have risked their lives to get to the truth. So I think that's, in some ways, that I'm wondering if this doesn't bring me back to my optimism about the future, that I don't think that pursuit of the truth can be extinguished in the human soul.
Mm.
In 1984, mm-hmm. Orwell's brilliant novel, we have a dark, dark vision of how that might be possible. So there is a fork in the road here. There is a choice available.
Mm-hmm.
And I desperately hope and believe that Europe and North America at this perilous moment, I don't think there's any exaggeration there, I think we will choose the right path, because that pursuit of truth, I think, has been deeply, deeply embedded in our cultures.
Is that pursuit of truth, doing so or not, what is represented in that fork?
I think it's one of the fundamental choices to be made. It's not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
There are other aspects of our way of life in addition to the truth. Mm-hmm. My own personal view is that I probably should have said this earlier, but I'm going to say it now.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's absolutely clear that the democracies of North America and Europe have also brought these problems upon themselves. Okay? I'm not pointing my finger at the Putins of this world and saying they have caused all this trouble. We have huge responsibility in Europe and North America for the crisis that we're in. And so, yes, we will have to fight to, I think it's about rediscovering the vital importance of the truth in a democracy, but that won't be enough. I'm opening many doors here to other conversations, so I don't want to distract us now, but just very quickly, we will need to have a reckoning soon with inequality and the profound damage that has been done by rising levels of inequality, the role of technology, social media.
Mm.
So this is not only about the truth. But coming back to the fork in the road, Catherine, that you mentioned, the choices that we have to make, I do think the truth will be fundamental. Because here's the thing. In everything that I've just said about the truth, Putin and others who seek to emulate him around the world, and they are many, will laugh and laugh again at me and the many people like me who believe that truth is important, because they will think that we are naive, soft,
malleable,
decadent even in our belief in the truth.
And they've more than benefited, capitalized on the opposite of truth.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I'm sure that we'll be pulling apart that complex sentiment throughout our conversation as it continues, and more facets will come up as to why that's so fundamental on your journey to say that, to be in that space. All right. Do you happen to have anything else that you wanted to add to the latest posed question?
No, I think we arrived at a good place there.
Wonderful.
I think that was a good conversation.
Fantastic.
And I think this idea that the storyteller and the visionary, mm-hmm. whoever they are, ultimately end up in the same place.
Yeah.
Truth, I think, is that makes sense to me.
Yeah, there was another element where you were talking about dictators for a moment, and the idea that you questioned truth in their process. Agenda came up as a word. So instead of vision, agenda is quite interesting as a distinction. And when you were talking about how people have a challenging time distinguishing between truth and falsehood today, that idea of vision compared to agenda is a wonderful example of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's go back to vision and what we're saying about vision. When democracy is at its best, and when political leaders are excelling, what are they doing? They are accepting that life is complex and difficult, because your political vision is an attempt to engage with the complexity of life in your community. You're not running away from it, you're embracing it. So your job as a politician is to present a compelling vision of the future, where we solve problems, where our children grow up with opportunity, where there are fewer people in our country who are poor, where we find ways to live together in respect, where we find ways to save our ecosystem. What could be more urgent than that? So you need a vision. The politician needs to articulate a vision, because these things are difficult and they require sacrifice.
You know, one of the areas we haven't touched upon yet that it behooves us to, as we close off this conversation, is well-being. The well-being of every individual on the planet. Because without that level of well-being, one can't function, one can't contribute to society, much less live their own lives. So, Jonathan, tell us about human rights. What are they?
When I think about human rights, I always dig again. We're back to digging. And this is the digging that gets us to dignity. There is no etymological link between the two.
They're beautiful, though.
It sounds good, but I think we know that there is no etymological link between digging
and dignity.
I'm going
to check as you talk. It's
I don't think so. But dig for what? Because this is it. It would be natural as a North European democratic citizen, or as a European citizen, to think that human rights are the foundation of everything. And they're not. Dig, 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 dig. There is something underneath human rights. There's something even more fundamental than that. And it's this. And this is where I use language where, I said earlier that I'm not a believer. I don't belong to a formal religion. But I feel, I've always felt, well, certainly as I get older, this is part of the midlife crisis, I think, the God-shaped hole, which is inside all of us that don't have a religion or not yet. And I sometimes feel that our secular language has limits, and you need the language of faith and religion to bridge that gap. I've had, you know, I've written to friends in need, friends who are really suffering. And it's not enough to say, I send you my love and best wishes. I have sometimes said, you know, I send you a prayer. I pray for you. And I say to myself, ooh, am I being untruthful here? Am I, can I say that?
Misaligned, perhaps?
I don't know. I do feel slightly uncomfortable when I say that. But I do it because I recognize the limits of my own language. And that it's just not enough to cross my fingers or hope that you get better, or there is something in the idea of saying a prayer, which I don't know. It just seems to give or offer more, a greater commitment, or the prospect of comfort, solace. I don't know.
Is there a religion of analogy and metaphor?
My first thought on that is that the Bible, whatever we think about the Bible, and I'm not going to go into that, but it's full of great stories and metaphor, because these people knew what they were doing. They were great storytellers. Mm-hmm. So very much so. Religion is, to state the obvious, religion is not a statement of facts.
So what if you were to replace that prayer and that email with a beautiful metaphor?
Well, yes. Yes. That's great advice.
With your abilities.
I think that's a great idea. I think that's a great idea.
That's sort of like your chunk of coal.
Yeah. No, I love that.
Turning it into a diamond, you mean?
No. The girl, the picture,
the original. The artwork. Yes, sure.
But let me just go back to this, to human rights and why I think there's something underneath human rights. There is a foundation beneath human rights, something that human rights sits on. And it's the idea of a soul. And that's the word I wanted to use, soul. Which has many connotations. It has Christian connotations, but it's also one of the great musical genres of the 20th century, soul music. But the reason I use that word is I believe that every child, wherever she is born, whatever her circumstances, is born with a dignity, a sacred dignity. There you go, another religious word. Every child is born with a sacred dignity that can never be taken away, that can never be diminished. And the reason I use the word soul is because that dignity that resides in that child, every child, is not in the body, it's not in the skin and the bones and the blood, it's in a human spirit that can never be defeated and never taken away. That's why we say soul. And that leads me to human rights, because I think human rights today in Europe, even as they are tragically and very worryingly being trampled on, those human rights are nonetheless one of the great achievements of our modern Europe, because we faced the abyss. We had come out of the abyss, the Holocaust. So that the European Union is built on the shame of Auschwitz. Yeah, the European Union is built and rooted in the shame of Auschwitz and a determination that can never, never, never happen again. So human rights for me it's not a legal doctrine. It is based on a human truth. It's my truth, but I think it's shared by, I hope it's shared by millions of Europeans and North Americans. That, let me just pause for a second, because I might be annoying people. I could imagine that I'm annoying people.
I've said more controversial things. It's okay.
No, I'm saying this when I, you know, every 5 minutes I say Europe and North America, there's a reason I'm doing that. It's out of a deep respect for the parts of the world that I just don't know. So I'm just trying to stay on steady ground where the ice is a little bit thicker. So the countries that I know, I hope, and you know, if I have to stick my neck out here or take one further step towards mm-hmm. the middle of the ice, I do believe that the vast majority of our human societies also believe in this idea that every child, wherever she is born, whatever her circumstances, has a dignity, a sacred dignity that can never be diminished, never taken away. And soul was the word that I used, and our human rights are built on that idea. And by the way, at this point, various nihilistic terrorists around the world, they've left the room again, laughing at people who believe this. This is the fork in the road, and this is what we are fighting for. Whether we are believers or not, for me, this transcends religion. This transcends religion. This idea that every child is born with this inherent sacred dignity.
So is the pursuit of truth essentially the pursuit of the soul?
I think it begins with the recognition that there is a soul. But here's the thing. I mean, I'm also aware that what I'm describing here is a truth. So these are, when we talk about values, these are choices made by communities. So they reach their version of the truth. Now, I've stated with a lot of confidence that for me, this idea of the soul, this sacred dignity within each human being from birth, I feel very confident that that is for me, a universal truth. But at the same time, I recognize immediately the limitations of that. And this is why I talk about Europe and North America, because I do believe for our parts of the world, many of us have, I think, bought into this idea. But I recognize that it may not be a truth for everybody. I think as an individual or a free and open society, I think you could pursue the truth without such a sacred and religious, I don't like using that word here, it doesn't feel right, but I think you can imagine a democratic, open society that which would pursue the truth without necessarily having such a vision of the soul. I can imagine that you could arrive at the notion of human rights in a more legalistic way. But that's for me when the institutions become fragile, when they're based on laws, rules, concepts. They need to be underpinned by a vision. They need to be underpinned by a vision and a set of beliefs. That's what gives them strength over time.
Do you often speak of the soul?
Sorry, do I often
speak of the soul?
More as I've gotten older, yeah. As I said, that there is that God-shaped hole that calls to you. It's difficult to avoid.
Is that your term, Jonathan? God-shaped hole?
I think it was a lyric from a song, okay. But I couldn't tell you which one.
Okay.
So here's a question. And this is not meant to be... let's be honest, this is a confrontational question. Do you hear yourself when you speak?
That's an interesting question.
And more precisely even, do you recognize when the statements you vocalize are for you?
I think in a conversation like this one, yes.
Wonderful.
because I realize that there are two things going on. As I said earlier, this is a conversation. And so what we're arriving at together, the three of us, I think, is a shared understanding of certain things. But I've already sensed in the time that we've been doing this, I've already sensed that together I certainly feel that I've opened up new doors, which,
wonderful,
which were not there before.
So important.
So you are prompting me again. You're prompting me to explore these questions, and often in new ways. So there is that going on, the conversation. But I also realize at the same time that I see myself and I hear myself trying to be clear.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
And to find, any writer is trying to find the right words.
Concise words.
Often concise. I'm
precise.
Absolutely.
Concise, precise. Certainly for, some of my favorite novelists write very, very long sentences. I'm fascinated.
I love those.
I'm fascinated by the ability to write a long sentence and keep the reader. It's a great talent. Certainly in my professional writing for business and in politics, I've often been drawn to clear writing, which often begins with short sentences.
Succinct.
Yes.
Efficient.
Yes.
And yet I know, Jonathan, you, even within those parameters and constraints, I would say, you elevate it because of your mastery with words.
That's very kind. That's very kind of you to say that. But I remember, again, back to George Orwell, who has floated like a benevolent ghost over this conversation, and rightly so, I think. Rightly so.
Floated like a benevolent ghost. Yeah. Wow.
Hi, George.
Hi, George.
He was a passionate believer in the need for good, clear language. And I think he said that if you can choose an old traditional Anglo-Saxon English word rather than a more flowery and certainly longer Latin Romance word, then do that. Just a tiny nerdy detail, but he was certainly passionate about the need for good, clear language.
Which is irrelevant if we're not speaking with others, right? That social component of language is quite fundamental to bringing the life into the words themselves.
Yes.
So tell me, why do you see a social setting as a competition? And the reason I ask that is because you referenced needing to win the space in a social setting. So why win? Who are we competing against?
I can feel that you're starting to put your finger on my weak spots now. I can feel
wonderful,
you're
let's do it.
Okay. Let me say this: competition. The idea of competition is I'm going to say something very personal now, but I hope it resonates with other people because I think it's important.
You know, just as a side note, this is partly about laying the foundation for us, this exchange. It's also a character profile. So when you can incorporate a personal thing here and there, it really helps to reinforce that image of you, that story of you and the listener.
Yeah.
And this all began a while ago with the question, tell us a bit about yourself. And it could have been, and maybe should have been, so who are you? So yes, please reveal.
Yeah. Let's start with on this word competition. I feel that this has been the biggest contradiction at the heart of my life, a contradiction that's now in its 53rd year, and I fear still alive and well and kicking inside me. And I'm saying to myself that I want to defeat, I almost frame it as defeating a demon.
Does that particular demon have a name?
Competition.
Oh,
and I say that because if I look at most of my professional life in Brussels, where I was really ploughing the traditional path of a communications advisor. I mean, you know this world, Marianne. I was competing with people to get jobs. And then inside those organizations, I was competing to come up with the best ideas, sometimes competing for the next promotion. And this is where the contradiction begins, because I have a clear memory that at those moments, I was telling myself a different story, that I didn't really want that next job. And this brings us back to David White, the poet, and his vision of crisis, the story we tell ourselves. And so, you know, if I look for the truth here, if I look for the truth and the evidence, I go back to primary school.
Good. It usually happens.
Yeah, here
little,
we go.
Little life.
You forced me down this path. I'm on the couch now. I'm on the couch.
Oh, dear.
Now you're worried.
I have to clarify, this is not therapy.
You did say that to me. But I was at a small primary school in Nottingham in the 1970s. Poetically, there's a part of Nottingham where my grandparents lived called Dunkirk. So spelt and pronounced the same as Dunkirk on the north coast of France, with its historical, its place in history. And if I tell you that from the beginning of primary school, so what, it's the age of 4 or 5 years old, until the age of 16, so secondary school, so if we jump from primary school to secondary school, if I tell you that in those 10, 12 years, I was never beaten once over 100 meters. And in secondary school, was never beaten in long jump and triple jump. This is what I was good at. Why am I telling you this now? Because I know that when I tell the story to myself that, I'm not really competitive, you know, competition's dirty and it gets you to do things for the wrong reasons. Yeah, I know that I've been bullshitting myself. Yeah,
very nice.
I've been bullshitting myself, and I suspect for much longer than just those.
The concept of Illumify will challenge that greatly, and the reason for that is because to Illumify is to hold a very high level of integrity in whatever it is that you are igniting, let's say. And when you identify this demon called competition, it is the exposure of something very powerful. And I refer to it as an Achilles. And more often than not, we have a few, until we don't. And that's where resolution comes in. So when one identifies an Achilles, like competition for you, it is an opportunity to also recognize that that is a way, a door through which you can walk in order to compromise yourself. So know that when competition begins to surface, bubble up to the surface, tempt you, coax you into a behavior or a pattern that you know is not of the highest integrity in that moment, you're being invited to compromise. As we walk down this road together, that is a very powerful card in your hand, to know that that's there.
Now, there may be people listening, maybe the majority even, who don't view competition as a negative. And yet, Jonathan, you do. So why is that?
Yeah, this is the thing. This is where we're getting to the heart of the matter here. You asked me that question, Marianne, and now I'm forced to ask myself, have I really, really seen it as a negative thing? Clearly not. At some level, you know, I know what my friends would say. They would say, they would look at the career that I had in Brussels and they would say, you did, you know, you had this job and you had this job. How can you possibly say that you were not competitive? And I'd have to hold my hands up and say, yeah, yeah, you're right.
When you referenced the word friend quite a few times, when you look at friendship, when you look at the act of socializing, do you see that as a sport as well?
No. That's a clear, thank God you've thrown me a lifeline there, Cathy.
Well, not necessarily.
A bit of safe ground in the ocean.
Maybe not.
In that space of the social setting, if you're fighting or competing, let's use your wording, competing for our space, it's a, give me something. What is people play sports on what? Pitches or courts?
Fields. Courts.
It's a field.
Yeah.
And in sport, there's more often than not, I'm guessing, a winner and a loser. So if you're fighting, if you're competing for space in a social setting, who is losing on account of that? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, that's where suddenly I have a little bit more clarity and confidence in what I'm saying. Friendship for me has been, it's almost the absence of competition. I would I'm almost tempted to define friendship as the absence of competition, a refuge. Friendship is a refuge from competition, a place where you go to escape competition.
And yet, and I hope this isn't true of you, but if you scan friends you may have had over decades, it's likely some were competing with you. Maybe there's a distinction here on true friendship. Back to the word true.
Yeah, that's a very insightful remark, because you immediately, what you've just said there takes us to that very interesting phenomenon where with our closest friends, the ones with whom we're most intimate, it's not only that we wish them success and enjoy their success, but we feel it as well. Now, you could take a skeptical view of that, perhaps even a cynical view, which says, well, yes, you feel it because you're taking a share of it. You're sharing in that success. You're taking
even by proximity.
Yeah, exactly. That's
vicarious.
Exactly. Then, yeah. It's that story which is never told because it's too shameful, but which says I sort of helped my friend together. But I don't think that's true. I think it's genuine. And that's what I felt, because I have thought about this question before. I've examined that emotion, and I think it's truthful. I think with our closest friends, I think we really do wish them well in everything and enjoy their success, but feel it as well. I don't think it's a desire to have a share of their success. I think it's almost the opposite. I think it's a sign that we have managed to break down the wall between ourselves and the other person, that the friendship is that good. We are that close with the other person that the walls have come down. So if the walls are down, and that person is feeling joy, how could we not feel joy as well?
Beautiful. Remember that.
I do love that image, but it immediately reminds me of the opposite as well, which is more uncomfortable, because it immediately raises the question, then envy. Where does envy come from? And if we're trying to be very honest here, and I promise you, I'm doing my best to be very honest. I know that I have often felt a real sense of envy towards friends. And the only thing that has saved me, and I can't remember who wrote this, I think it may have been Simon Cooper, columnist in the Financial Times. I think he may have written this once, that envy is actually a good thing. And let me throw this out to you, Marianne and Catherine, as a as a provocative idea for you. Envy is a good thing because it tells us what we want. It gives us a signal about what we want. And if I look at the people I have envied recently in Copenhagen, this suddenly feels very raw because I'm talking about things I've experienced in recent weeks, yeah? I have seen the work of fellow writers in my writing group. We meet every 2 weeks. People who, like me, are trying to...
Well done. To,
thank you. Mm-hmm. And there are moments where I'm deeply envious of what they can do. And I really struggle with that.
Okay, well, here's a way not to struggle with it. The only way that envy can be a good thing because it shows us a want or a desire is if we perceive a want or a desire as a good thing as well.
Yes. Yes. And this and the story that I tell myself is that, okay, the initial expression of that emotion may not be very pretty and possibly not conducive to good and enduring friendship either.
Yeah.
But
it's there.
But it's there, and that what I should take from that, this is the story I tell myself, what I should take from that is not to have what they have, which is the most basic, I guess, the most basic idea of what envy is, not to have what they have, but to be inspired by what they have done, I guess. I mean, I'm not sure here. It's this is where I'm thinking about something properly for the first time, I think.
Wonderful. Wow.
But maybe follow them in their path and obviously not copy them, but try to figure out...
Formula for success.
What they had to do, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And be honest with yourself and say, well, look, if you want to get to that same standard, and this could apply to anything, then... Okay, it's good that you want that, but now you have to have an honest conversation about what you need to do.
Desire can make things confusing, complex.
Yes, those feelings recently have been very, very uncomfortable. Where, again, this goes back to the storytelling. The story I tell myself is, I'm here with these people. How could I possibly be competing with them? We're trying to write books. How could we be competing? We're in this noble journey towards our own work. We're doing different work. We're on parallel paths, and we're there to encourage each other and share ideas and give each other moral support. I mean, so there's a very noble story that I'm telling myself.
Yeah.
And sometimes, and this is where I feel very disappointed in myself, deeply disappointed in myself. Those moments where you say, "Who am I? Who am I?" It's when that story crumbles very quickly.
If you have a unique voice and can only say things that you can say, and if that's true for everyone else as well, and certainly for the writers in your group, no one is your competition.
Correct. I agree with that 100%.
And that's where alignment is so critical, because it's when we veer out of it. You know, when you are in perfect alignment with who you are and you express it, that is the distinction. No one can emulate. It is only you. It's only when we step out of alignment with that.
The reason why we're discussing these points with you is because they will be confrontations you will have with yourself throughout this process. Very important to get comfortable with the discomfort.
Mm. Yes.
I do want to add one more perhaps component to look at, Jonathan, because you've spoken so poignantly about the critical importance of truth and to being true in who you are. And so I'll play devil's advocate for a moment with respect to competition. If you map your career, for example, back to being truly who you are, who you were then, even on one dimension, and that dimension would be, we'll use writing capability, okay? Given your caliber now, yes, of course, experience strengthens expertise and capability, absolutely. But many, most people, and I know a lot of writers, and I'm thinking particularly of those who write for others, nonfiction speeches and the like, when you have a high level of capability to begin with, whether you want to or not, you rise above the others. So if in being your true self is only about being true to your capability, your voice, your ability to voice for others, it's really not so much about competition. It is about being true.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. I think the story I told myself for a long time when I was in that professional world, writing for other people, as you say, I think the story I told myself to try and maintain the modest story that I was telling myself, that I wasn't competing, I think the way I did that was by saying that I had branched off and was doing something a little more specific that other people weren't doing, a niche activity.
Distinct?
Yes. And that I suddenly realized, certainly in the professional world, that there seemed to be very, very few people who actually cared about language. And this was, I remember at the time thinking, hang on, this doesn't make sense. There are all these people working in the field of communications, but nobody seems particularly fascinated or...
Nope.
Nobody really seems to care about the words themselves.
Nope. It's often about efficiency, expediency.
Sure.
And practicality, pragmaticism, really.
Yeah.
Not reaching for the heights.
Yeah.
And even if they do, they get sanctioned often for it. So, yeah, your true love for language, which you began with, is distinct. And you are distinct. And again, you could have, at any juncture, just said, oh, well, you know, I don't want to shine above. I don't want others to feel that, I got something that they did not. Just map that to being true to who you are in all the dimensions. And I think competitiveness isn't very significant. It would be more significant if you played small or undermined, diminished your own capability so as not to compete.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
You're going to have lots of opportunities for reflection here. And I thank you for being so honest and open. And I knew that you would be. And I certainly, I had the privilege of knowing you before this. But I know that anyone listening will now come away already with a sense of who you are that is only going to be strengthened, deepened, challenged over the upcoming questions. That may be a good place to stop.
Yeah.
Feels
like a natural pause.
It does. Shall we begin?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have things to say, Jonathan declared. The visionary and the storyteller have to end up in the same place. The truth. And the pursuit of truth matters. Every child is born with a sacred dignity that can never be taken away. Already he's revealed threads of what's to come. I'm Marianne Gobet. Thank you for accompanying us on the Leader's Journey. To fully experience the passage to igniting meaningful change, subscribe to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. To learn more about the Illumify Game Changer and how to embark on your own leader's journey, please visit Illumify's website at illumifyinstitute.com. You matter. Step up. Speak up. Together, let's ignite meaningful change.